It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and supported by Room & Board, handcrafted furniture for your home at roomandboard.com. Well, today we talk with Chris Fair. Now, she's a political and military analyst with a culinary approach to foreign affairs. Warm and fuzzy, this is not. Her book is, and I love this title, Cuisines of the Axis of Evil and Other Irritating States, A Dinner Party Approach to International Relations. We have the favorite food books of England's food star, and by the way, formerly a literary editor of the Sunday Times. I'm talking about Nigella Lawson. Then it's what makes one restaurant a legend and another one just old. Gourmet's John Willoughby has the clues and the picks across the country. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. So let's get rolling with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine.
Lynn, 25 years ago, if you had asked us what our favorite road food was in the United States, we probably would have said Butler's Donuts in Massachusetts. We just went back there to their new location, which is in Somerset, Massachusetts, and I'm thinking it's going back on my top 10 list because never has there been a more perfect, delicious, pure, and wonderful donut that I've ever tasted in the world. It is filled with real whipped cream, and the outside of it is this ethereal sort of cream puff pastry.
Huh.
The whole place is very working class, you know, cops and truckers eating
right,
there.
Right.
But the pastries are really the gentlest, most delicate, most aristocratic pastries I think I've had.
Well, and in fact, to call them donuts, at least, doesn't really quite make sense. For one thing, they don't have a hole in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
You either get these giant featherweight cream puffs that are sliced in half and filled with either whipped sweetened cream or whipped sweetened and mocha flavored cream.
Uh-huh.
Or even better, you can get what they call a Long John. Which is the ultimate donut. I mean, it's a you know, long shape. It's a
right.
It's tubular.
Sort of tubular. That's cut in half and filled with cream, plus a line of dark raspberry jelly. And the combination of that dark raspberry jelly, this kind of dense, real, fresh, farmy whipped cream, and that ethereal pastry around it, dusted with sugar, is really one of the great pastries ever anywhere.
We went back there about a month ago, and as I said earlier, we had originally been there in the 1980s.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, maybe it's my gloomy, pessimistic side, but I thought, this place has to have changed. They must be using, you know, Whippo in the middle of it, and it can't be as brilliant as I remember it. Well, it is exactly the same, even though it's in a different location. It's worth a trip from
anywhere
in the world. If you happen to be in Singapore, you should detour and go to Somerset, Massachusetts.
You know, I realize something as you say this, because my mother used to whip up cream puffs, you know, literally at the drop of a hat.
Really?
Nobody makes these things anymore.
No.
But, I mean, that's so interesting that they've built a business doing these. It sounds like a throwback maybe to the 1940s almost.
Yeah, or even the 1920s. I mean, it struck me when I went in there and I saw the clientele. And, you know, as I said, there were cops and truckers and working people and, you know, nothing fancy. And
mm-hmm.
the dichotomy between these, you know, cream puffs that look like they should be on, you know, a ladies' bridge club table
right.
in the 1930s, and these, you know, sort of meat-handed workmen eating them was really quite strange and wonderful and hilarious.
How elegant and delicate. Thanks, guys.
Well, that's our middle name, Lynn. Bye.
Bye-bye, Lynn.
Well, I'm as hard as nails. I'm known to be tough. A man among males, and I take no guff. Oh, yeah, oh, yeah. I'm pretty rough. But when I'm close to you, I'm just a little cream puff.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Two for the Road. Now, you can hear the Sterns here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime you want. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. An email came in asking how to save money on organic foods. The writer said that he bought organic food for his kids but couldn't afford it for family adults. Well, that said, they were rethinking this and wanted my take on the best buys in organic shopping. Well, granted, this could change from place to place, but the best buys that I can think of are in bulk grains and beans. Now, this is the pleasure part, the good eating. First, no two taste alike, and all of them taste good. Second, if you put a grain and a bean together, you've got a complete protein, just like eating a piece of meat. Third, there is a lifetime's worth of recipe possibilities. At least one-third of the planet lives on grains and beans, like spicy Caribbean red beans and rice, Italian chickpea and barley risotto, Indian curried rice and lentils. Anyway, you get the idea. Now, from the ecological point of view, this is eating about as low on the food chain as you can get. And from the money side, organic beans and grains range from about 80 cents to maybe 250 a pound. And a pound could be the mainstay of a meal for 4 to 6 people. And I think that's a pretty good buy. When you think Nigella Lawson, you think British TV food celebrity and someone who loves her food in spite of being movie star gorgeous, someone who is wont to snack out of the fridge at midnight, and a woman who insists that she is not a professional cook. What you may not know, though, is that Nigella was a literary editor at the prestigious Sunday Times. Nigella, welcome back.
It's lovely to be here.
Nigella, when it comes to books on food, how do your tastes run?
I think really promiscuously, which is to say that I have an appetite for all manner of books about food. I think, in a way, I suppose the most affecting are books that aren't centrally about food, but somehow food is such a central part of the book. For example, I mean, I suppose it's hard not to think of Heartburn by Nora Ephron. Mm-hmm. It's fantastically funny. It's really heart-piercingly sad. And yet, of course, it is really compulsive about food. And I suppose I have a certain sympathy for the character too, because she's a food writer, but she's not a food expert, really. I'm not. And there's a fantastic demo she's giving once when she's trying to cut a watermelon, and some of the watermelon lands on the lap of the person in the demo in the audience. And I love that. But generally, I suppose it's really how food is part of the fabric of our emotions and our lives. And that is very, very potent. And I suppose I'd say neck and neck with Heartburn is a book by the late short story writer and novelist, but really a fantastic short story writer, Laurie Colwyn.
Oh, yes.
Who wrote a book called Home Cooking, you know, and more home cooking as well. Now, to me, that's one of the most moving books, really. It's they're essays, they're stories about her life. She was a young woman with a young daughter. It's everyday stories, and recipes weave their way in and out. It's not a cookery book or a food book by any means, but it's extraordinary about the lives we lead, the thoughts we have in our head, the emotions we have, and how food is what connects us to everyone and everything around us. I've always thought it was an extraordinary book, this.
Extraordinary. It is, and it's interesting because
radical.
I think when it came out, we hadn't seen anything quite like that.
No, I think that's right, and I certainly hadn't. I was writing How to Eat at the time, my first book, which was really not an illustrated cookbook and very much my witterings about food. I'm very glad to say that I was given Home Cooking after I'd finished it, because really, she did so much better what I had been trying to do that had I read it when I was still writing, I'd have given up, because I think it's a fantastic book.
What kind of books give you ideas?
I think the sort of books that give me ideas the most are books which come out of, if you like, an intertwinement of passion and erudition. Because I love to learn and I love to be made enthusiastic. And, for example, there's a writer I think is extraordinary, called Anna Del Conte, who's in a bit like our version, a sort of British version of Marcella Hazan.
Mm-hmm.
She
mm-hmm.
came to England just as a tourist when she was 18, and she was looking around St. Paul's Cathedral and fell in love with a young man there, married him, and stayed forever in London. So it's a rather fantastic story. So what she did for us here was translate Italian food to the British sensibility, and in doing so allowed us to learn how to cook it.
Is there anything about the, I'm thinking about what's being written now, mm-hmm. about what the new food science, the taking apart of flavors, that sort of thing. Is any of that intriguing you at this point?
What intrigues me about the whole, if you like, molecular gastronomy and trying to be novel for its own sake is what it says about where we are in society now, this incredible, if you like, bifurcation between the affluent who've got nothing better to do than to think about how to, you know, serve a honey meringue with a fish, and mm-hmm. the other part who for whom there's just not enough to eat. It just seems to me, I mean, this is probably an aggressive thing to say, but I find it an extreme act of decadence. However, where I have some sympathy and more than a little interest is that I think I can see, particularly with men, I'm sorry if it sounds sexist, but how the scientific aspect, the laboratory testing, must be very compulsive. And I'm sure that were one to start doing that, to try and think of new methods, you know, but it is sometimes the equivalent of, you know, thinking I could get a nuclear reactor to boil an egg. You know, we've been boiling eggs in water for a long time. There's no need. But nevertheless, I'm interested in a condescending way. I have no desire to cook like that or really to read a book like that. Does that sound too aggressive?
No, that sounds like exactly what you think of it.
Yeah.
What about a sentimental favorite, the food book you would never part with?
It's very difficult to choose one food book I'd never part with because I think so many, and I suspect the Anna Del Conte is slightly that for me. But I certainly feel that there's a book that I think is such a beautiful read, which is Jane Grigson's fruit book, you know, and her vegetable book equally. I wouldn't really like to choose between the two. But that sense of serendipitous discovery, that you can flick through a book and find something that you didn't know you even wanted to read a recipe for. And I think there's something about the quietness of her tone, the way you feel you are held by such a keen and unassuming intelligence. It reminds me slightly, I suppose, of sitting with my grandmother and reading that sort of a book, because my grandmother was a very keen gardener. So mm-hmm. any book that had recipes for, you know, vegetables, which you suddenly had in abundance, was the sort of book she would always want to have. And there is something fantastic about just having a garden, or thinking the dream of it, picking, you know, tending your produce, and mm-hmm. then maybe just thinking of a different way to cook it, in a way that really is so much about the produce and not about the recipe. And I think that, for me, gives me a sentimental twinge, I suppose. It reminds me of the past, and maybe I hope to have, you know, an old age, like one of those dowdy British old bags with, you know, very muddy hands and a trowel.
I can just see this, Nigella. Yes, I can see it in your
future.
Something
to aim for, you've got to admit.
Nigella, thank you.
Thank you.
British food celebrity Nigella Lawson is author of Nigella Express. Now, you can get her recipe for potato mushroom gratin, well, you know where, on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to check out our newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, our podcasts, and information on our new book designed to get you to sit down and eat well with friends and family. It's called The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper, Recipes, Stories, and Opinions. Now you're going to find that all at splendidtable.org. Coming up, Noshing with the Excess of Evil, Ham Biscuits and Hostess Gowns, and The Restaurant as Legend. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is supported by Room & Board Home Furnishings, where they believe in furniture designed for a lifetime. You can find handcrafted American-made furniture and accessories for every room in your home at roomandboard.com. Chris Fair calls herself an eccentric think tank chick. She's worked with a number of think tanks around the world and has a background in political and military analysis. Now, she claims most of what we eat has its share of baggage, be it militarized, religious, social, or political. She just carries that idea a tad further than most. Chris has done a book called Cuisines of the Axis of Evil and Other Irritating States, A Dinner Party Approach to International Relations. Chris, welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Chris, food and politics have been bedfellows for sort of all eternity. But where did the idea of this book come from? Because this is political diatribe, practically.
Well, that's true. It's certainly the use and abuse of the genre of the cookbook. But actually, the origins of it very much are food related. I was sitting in a diner in Santa Monica when the notorious Axis of Evil speech was playing out in the diner. And I've always been food obsessed. So the idea that that would be a fabulous cookbook that someone would write struck me almost immediately. It just didn't occur to me that I'd be the one that would be trying to tackle that literary endeavor. But very soon afterwards, it really came home for me, the whole Axis of Evil nonsense. You know, I study South Asia security as a part of my day job. And obviously, you know, I knew that what went down in 9/11 had its footprints were in Afghanistan and Pakistan, not in Iraq. And this all came home when shortly thereafter, in the fall of 2002, actually, both of my brothers were called up to go to Iraq. They're in the Indiana National Guard. And the National Guard is like the British regimental system. Everyone gets called up. It's not like the regular army where two brothers would never be deployed together. And throughout that year, since my brothers are really my only family, my mom passed away and I didn't really know my dad, this had to have been the worst year imaginable. It was just unbelievable to me that my brothers were in harm's way. And when I get stressed out, some people eat, I cook. I cook like a crazy lunatic. And the dinner party and having friends over really became my way of getting through that year.
One of the things you do in this book, I mean, every country that you talk about has a menu.
Absolutely.
Were you cooking? I mean, during that year, were you cooking the food that was the food of Iraq, for instance?
Well, we did. We very quickly began having the Axis of Evil dinner parties. And I think somewhat early on, I did begin having the idea that once my dissertation is written, this is going to be a fun cookbook. So some of the countries that I focused on were actually foods that I knew better. Like I had spent some time in Iran in 2001. I was studying Farsi there. And so some of the earlier dinner parties were actually Iranian.
So each section's devoted to a country, and you talk at length about its history and about its politics, and you're not shy about opinion. But if you could use one country as an example of this whole approach, which one do you think it might be?
Well, I think actually for me, the Israel chapter most personifies the deep connection between the symbolism of food and policy. When I was in Israel doing field work for the cookbook, I was really struck by postcards and T-shirts that say falafel is our national food. And it really struck me as interesting that, A, food has always been part of that evolving inventory of national symbols that countries hoist up to say, this is us, this is what we present to the world. And many countries are notorious for this. Obviously, we know about the French baguette. So it struck me as really interesting that what the Israelis were saying to folks that visited their shores was falafel's our national food. And so it struck me is that this was sort of a creating a culinary fact on the ground that obviously, you know, accompanied some of the other issues, such as the settlements, which are creating other facts on the ground. So it struck me that of all of the things that they could hoist up, it would be falafel, which is absolutely not what people here in the United States would associate. If you were to ask your average American, what do you think is the Israeli national food? I'm pretty certain falafel would not be on that list.
Right.
And so, you know, I began talking to, you know, I do a lot of interviews, for example, on Al Jazeera. And actually, this is a point of very serious vexation among Arabs. So, like, of all the foods you could have claimed that would be obviously yours, why are you picking our food?
So this really is a bone of contention?
Yeah, because Arabs, I think, see it. This is a further extension of the Israeli attempt to appropriate Arab culture, Arab land.
Uh-huh.
And so I think they are also making this connection that this is sort of culinary colonization in the same way that the settlements are physical colonization of Palestinian land. So, I think intellectually, I'm really interested in how countries pick these symbols of nationalism and how they develop them and promote them.
So your day job is a terrorist analyst. Does food figure into that work?
Well, it actually does in an odd way. One of the areas that I focus on is upon Kashmir. And for years, there's been a lot of questions about how many militants are actually up there, how many are actually infiltrating. Mm-hmm. And a number of years ago, I had a conversation with a journalist associate. I was trying to figure out, as many of us were and are, the current state of the insurgency in Kashmir. At the height of that insurgency, you were having every day groups of 40, 50, 100 people crossing. After 9/11, when the world basically said, no more militancy, we're not changing borders through militancy, a lot of pressure was placed upon Pakistan to stop supporting militants crossing into Indian-administered Kashmir and to try to make that operational environment difficult for them to, mm-hmm. to work in. So I was talking to this journalist, and I was like, what is really going on? Because when I talk to Indians, they're still saying militants are crossing, yet there seems to be a consensus that fewer are crossing than a few years ago. Well, this particular journalist, what he did, he went up and he talked to the militant commanders. They said, oh, no, there's only like 10 or 15 of us. Pressure is really on us to stop operating. Well, he said, thank you very much for your opinion. He then went and interviewed the cook. And the cook, quite the contrary, was cooking for 40 people. And at altitude, you don't cook for 40 people unless 40 people are eating, because it's just hard to get food up there. And to me, this had to be one of the most brilliant things I'd ever seen anyone do, because who would have thought of talking to the cook? Yet the cook, more so than anyone else, you can see his pot, you can see what he's cooking, you can see, are they cooking chicken? Are they cooking goat? So they're cooking, goat and chicken, it means someone's giving them goat and chicken. Are they eating simple meals of dal? Those are really important signifiers to what kind of support that they're enjoying, and obviously an important signifier of their footprint.
Very interesting. Chris, thank you.
Thank you.
Terrorist analyst Chris Fair is author of Cuisines of the Axis of Evil and Other Irritating States, A Dinner Party Approach to International Relations. Now, you can find her recipe for a Pakistan chickpea dish, spiced chickpeas, or Peshawari chana on the website, splendidtable.org. Southern hospitality is no slouch. This isn't myth. I'm an unbiased Yankee, and I can attest from firsthand experience that people in the South know something that I don't. And food is personal in the South. I think that's maybe why you see so many recipe titles with people's names in them. Well, writer Julia Reed grew up Southern, and along with writing, food as personal ID is in her DNA. Julia's done a book about Southern entertaining. It's called Ham Biscuits, Hostess Gowns, and Other Southern Specialties. Julia Reed, good to have you with us.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Julia, there's something I can't quite pinpoint. It's a sense. Every time I'm in the South, first of all, food tastes different. And I'm not talking just about the recipes. And secondly, people seem to have a better time at the table. Now, I mean, is this me romanticizing, or is eating different there, getting together different there?
Well, we'll use any excuse to get together and eat. Food is sort of an excuse, I guess, to gather, but nobody would think about gathering without food. I mean, you don't go over to somebody's house for a drink in the South unless they have, they've got a cheese straw waiting for you, or that great delicacy, a block of Philadelphia cream cheese with pickled pepper sauce on it or something like that. I mean, you just don't, you wouldn't have somebody over without something, a bowl of salted pecans, a plate of cheese straws, that kind of thing. I do think that people are more passionate about food. Southern cooks are incredibly proud, and my mother after Hurricane Katrina, we had a lot of, in her hometown where she still lives in Mississippi, we had a lot of refugees come up there, evacuees, and she fed them supper one night. She was in charge of feeding, like, literally, you know, several hundred people for mm-hmm. dinner, and she was peeling the tomatoes because she said they're so much better that way. And, you know, she wouldn't dare serve her guests unpeeled tomatoes, so certainly the evacuees were going to get the same treatment.
Bless her. Yeah, this is a perfect segue, because this business of Southern hospitality, how is entertaining different in the South?
Well, you know, the essays in this book came about because I had a cocktail party in Manhattan where I used to live, and I serve what I always serve, which is like ham biscuits and stuffed eggs or deviled eggs and you know, a giant punch bowl full of lump crab meat that had been tossed in homemade mayonnaise, that kind of thing. Sliced tenderloin on Sister Schubert's yeast rolls, which are a great secret. And the next morning, a guy from the New York Times Magazine who had been there called me up and said, would you like to write about food? And it had never occurred. I mean, I love cooking, and I, you know, I like to write, but and I do it for a living, but it never occurred to me to be a food writer. It'd be too much fun to get paid. And I think that what got him was that, you know, usually when you go to cocktail parties in New York, it's, you know, very sort of stringent. It's like, okay, come by from 6 to 8, and they might pass you some dried out satay, you know, on a skewer or an undercooked snow pea piped with something unintelligible. And so I serve what I want to eat, some hot biscuits with melted butter on and a big old slice of ham. Who doesn't like a stuffed egg? But it took me a while to understand that myself, actually. At first, when I moved to New York, I thought I needed to be sort of pretentious and have perfect food. And my mother, I was agonizing over a menu one night, and she said, why don't you just serve some food that tastes good? And it was a great lesson, and I took it to heart.
You say in the book she entertained a lot. How did she entertain?
Well, you know, lavishly, like I said. I mean, she's peeling tomatoes for people she doesn't know. She's really going to put on the dog for her friends. I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, in the introduction, I wrote about this dinner party she had for some friends of mine when I was 4 or 5 years old. It was around Easter time, and she and her best friend had blown out some eggs and made votive candles in the shapes of eggs. And so it's this incredibly beautiful table lit by these pastel egg-shaped votive candles. And it's, you know, obviously some lavish dinner, and we had chocolate eggs for dessert that they'd made themselves. And I thought, what in the world motivated them to do that for our kindergarten-age selves? But, I mean, you know, that's the standard, so you do it for everybody. The bar was set high.
Julia Reed, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Julia Reed is author of Ham Biscuits, Hostess Gowns, and Other Southern Specialties. Now, you can find the recipe that Julia calls Nancy Peterkin's Summer Squash Casserole on the website, splendidtable.org. It isn't enough for Gourmet Magazine's executive editor John Willoughby to run a magazine. He also writes award-winning cookbooks and articles, and he's constantly roaming the world, checking out local food scenes. John, it's good to have you back.
Thanks, Lynn.
So, John, what do you think makes a restaurant a legend?
Well, you know, that's a good question, and we spent a lot of time figuring that out, because one thing is you have to have been around a long time.
Yeah.
And another thing is you have to have been at one point good. And the third thing is you have to still be good. And those three things go together sometimes, but a lot of times they don't. So we set out to find the restaurants that had been around since before the beginning of Gourmet, which is 1941. So it's really a long time.
Yeah.
That were still turning out great, distinctive food. And we found 20 of them.
But don't you think personality figures into this?
Absolutely. I don't think that you're going to last for 70 years unless you have a distinctive personality. And I think every one of the places that we ended up including is something that you wouldn't find anywhere else because it's of its neighborhood, it's of its city and region, and I think that's one of the reasons that they last so long. And, of course, the people who run them as well. We found a restaurant where most of the servers were the third generation.
Wow.
So,
Which one was that?
It's El Charro. El Charro in Tucson, Arizona.
Uh-huh.
And the food is really great. So A lot of the places we went had personality. They had staying power, but the food has sort of gone downhill, or they're in a low point right now. But many of these places, all the places we put on the list, still have great food.
So give me some examples.
Well, I mean, you would expect that we would find them in New York and San Francisco and Chicago. But the interesting thing to me was we also found them in very out-of-way places like the Bright Star in Bessemer, Alabama, where they serve their specialty as fried red snapper throats, which you probably don't find too many other places.
No, I haven't seen a fish throat in a fish store for a long time. Yeah.
For a while. And in rural New Jersey, there's a place called Sammy's Ye Old Cider Mill where you go in. Despite the name, the food is good. You go in and you place your order and then you go downstairs. And when your order is ready, they come and get you and all the food is on the table. It's kind of an unusual way of doing service.
It's like dinner at home.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of these places are very homey. Some of them are swelligant, like the 21 Club in New York, but many of them are very homey. The oldest one we found is the Tadich Grill in San Francisco, which, of course, has been around since 1849.
Oh, yeah.
And is still serving great food.
So what I'd love to know is the most unusual of the lot?
The most unusual of the lot? Well, that's a very good question. I think it might be the Mango Hotel, which is in a rural part of the Big Island of Hawaii.
Right.
And it got to start serving plantation workers. The man who started it was coming from the East, and he ran out of money and stopped in Hawaii. He was planning to come to the U.S., and he started this hotel, which is still serving today. But it has a very set menu. They have a pork chop that's cooked in a particular pan, a square pan, and that's the only thing that pan is used for. But the oddest thing about it is if you're not there by 7:30, you don't get dinner. You have to be in the restaurant sitting down by 7:30 because that was plantation hours. So they're still doing this. And they serve also two kinds of seaweed that are only found in Hawaii. When they've got them, when they've got the seaweed, they serve these seaweed salads. So you don't get it anywhere else.
Is there any, I mean, I guess if you had to pick one place that's the most, iconic of legendary restaurants, is there any one you could select?
I might go with either the 21 Club in New York or my personal favorite is Lockover's in Boston because it has been there forever. And it has these very strange customs, which until 1971, women were not allowed to eat in the main dining room. They could eat downstairs, but they couldn't come in the main dining room except on New Year's Eve and on the day of the Harvard-Yale game, but only if Harvard won. So it's totally idiosyncratic. And now it's still got all this that same tradition, all those great copper serving pots and all that, but it's been taken over by Lydia Shire, so it's got updated, fantastic food. So it's got all the iconic history and sort of outfittings, but it's got great food, too.
And a woman chef. There is divine
Absolutely.
Justice. I love it. John, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
John Willoughby is executive editor of Gourmet Magazine. The article on legendary restaurants appeared in the October 2008 issue of Gourmet. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, this week's question is, does an apple a day really keep the doctor away? We're going to be back in a moment with that answer, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us, 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is supported by Room & Board Home Furnishings, where they believe in furniture designed for a lifetime. You can find handcrafted American-made furniture and accessories for every room in your home at roomandboard.com. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, does an apple a day really keep the doctor away? Well, according to MD Robert H. Schmerling, writing in Harvard Health Publications, there are some recent studies in the apple's favor. Here's the short take. An apple a day could cut calories. In 2007, researchers from Pennsylvania State University found that study subjects who ate an apple before lunch, about 125 calories, consumed 187 fewer calories overall than subjects who didn't eat an apple. Now, applesauce and apple juice, on the other hand, had no such effect. An apple a day could help your lungs. Also in 2007, researchers in England found that 5 apples a week might increase lung function and lower the risk of asthma. There's more scientific speculation on his list, but the takeaway here is, why not?
Hello? Hey, what's going on? How come I never see you around no more? Where you been? Yeah, well, you should call me.
We're opening the lines for your calls, brought to you by Palm Wonderful. 100% authentic pomegranate juice at palmwonderful.com. Now you can reach us at 800-537-5252. Anything goes. Okay, let's see who is calling. We've got Stephen from St. Louis. Stephen, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. How are you today?
I am good.
First off, I want to say that Cece and I are enjoying your How to Eat Supper book.
Hey, thank you.
Yes.
Thanks a lot.
I want to talk about movies for people who love to eat.
Oh, I love that.
Our friends and I, have been getting together, having dinner and a movie. And we've chosen movies that have a dinner theme, like Chocolat, we've made mole chicken.
So you all cook together? How many are
you? Yeah, about 6 of us in the kitchen. It gets very crowded.
It sounds like a lot of fun.
We had a Babette feast. We had mashed cod as a first course, and then we had a cassoulet.
That's brilliant. I like that.
We had who was killing the great chefs of Europe, and I made a chocolate raspberry bomb for dessert.
That, by the way, is perhaps one of my, I mean, forget the art films, right? That is perhaps one of my all-time favorite.
It's a guilty pleasure.
Oh, it is. And if you know the scene at that time, because that book, I think that movie was made like in the 70s, it was a spoof on every famous French chef at the time. The actors that they chose did these fascinating switches of character. There was like inside, and inside jokes in that film.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, go on. Okay.
Well, we're looking for new movies to watch and
new
to make
movies.
Winners make them, because I don't want to do Silence of the Lambs and have liver with fava beans and a good Chianti yet.
Oh, but he ate a lot of things. I mean, he did brains. He did sweetbreads.
You know, I'm having an old friend for dinner on Saturday, but I don't want to have an old friend for dinner.
Okay.
We have a couple that are coming up. We're making Osso Buco on Saturday night, and we're having Under the Tuscan Sun.
All right. Okay, because the other thing I was thinking of was Moonstruck.
Mm.
Moonstruck, you know, there's a ton of food scenes
mm-hmm.
in it. The family is Southern Italian. They're Sicilian, in fact, which opens up a whole world of fabulous dishes. And, you know, Sicily has this so much Arab influence and Greek influence on the
okay.
foods, and there's a lot of sweet, sour spice. The Sicilians know more about using mint in cooking than any other culture, I think, in the world.
Okay.
Also, Buco would not necessarily be Sicilian. I think you're right about Under the Tuscan Sun.
Yeah.
All right. Aside from that, what else could you do? Tortilla Soup. Do you know the film?
No, I don't.
It is a remake, I think, of it's a remake of another film. But at any rate, it's a setting of a chef from Mexico. And he's lost his taste. He's a great chef. And he's lost his taste when his wife dies.
Oh.
And he has 3 daughters. And you'd be looking at things like sautéed plantain and guacamole and fabulous homemade tamale. I'd say take a look at the film. It's a fun film. You'll enjoy watching it. And, of course, Big Night with the fabulous, fabulous Celebration Timbal. I mean, Big Night is the Stanley Tucci film, the two brothers, 1950s. They've opened an Italian restaurant. The brother is a classic cook. And he does these fabulous feasts, and they think the food critic is going to come, and finally they'll be recognized for what they're about. And he does one of the great dishes of old-time Italian feasting with a sweet crust filled with pasta and meat sauce and whatever. But the story is great. Isabella Rossellini is in it.
Oh, I love her.
And if you want, I don't mean to, you know, do self-promotion, but if you want a recipe that would work, in my first book, Splendid Table, there's the tortellini pie.
Okay.
Now, you have to understand, this is something that 6 people probably could do start to finish, but otherwise it's been known if you try to do it the same day you serve it, you will die. Okay, because it's a very elaborate recipe, but you'll be rolling your own pasta and whatever. It's fabulous. No one has tasted anything like this.
Good deal.
So that's another one. How about, like, Water for Chocolate?
Ooh, nice.
Yeah, you've done the mole thing, but how about, was it quail with rose petals, as I remember? Ooh. There's lots of things in that book and in the movie. That would be, what a fantastical film that is.
Well, we needed another excuse for chocolate.
Yeah, and but that film is so fabulously evocative. I think that would be fabulous. And then the end of it, of course, is fire. So maybe at the end you roast sweet tamale in the fire. And anyway, that's another idea. Tampopo, the wonderful Japanese movie where they're looking for the perfect noodle soup. But in the process, there's this fabulous scene between the two young lovers where they're both gastronomes and they're kissing as they exchange a raw egg yolk back.
Oh.
And it is one of the most, it sounds awful, but it is one of the most sensual things you will ever see. And I don't think they're touching each other other than kissing. But Tampopo would be a wonderful way to explore Japanese food. What about fried green tomatoes? What about great Americana? I mean, that would be a wonderful celebration of Southern food.
That sounds great.
Yeah. So I think that'll get you started.
Yeah, well, I think I have a few here.
Hey, Stephen, let us know what you pick. Keep us posted on what you guys are cooking
Thank
and
you.
What you're watching. Okay?
Okay. All right.
Take
you,
care.
Man. Bye.
Call us 800-537-5252. Let's see. Who is up next? We have got Joseph calling from Bethel, Vermont. Joseph, what do you want to talk about?
Okay. Well, here's the story. Last September, my wife and I were married.
Congratulations.
And, thank you very much. And because she is a teacher, we put off our honeymoon until this past June. And so it was really exciting. We went to Austria for 3 weeks, spent some time in Vienna, and then we ended up for 2 weeks in a small town called Maria Alm, which is near Salzburg. And while we were there, we absolutely fell in love with this dish. It's a Tyrolean dish.
Right.
And it's called either Fleischnacken or Specknacken. She remembers Fleischnacken, I remember Specknacken, so she's probably right.
Uh-huh.
We fell in love with it, and we figured, you know, we'll come back to the States, go online, find a cookbook or something, and
right.
just easily be able to find the recipe. No such luck, and so you are our culinary expert of last resort.
Describe the dish.
Okay, sure. It is primarily made up of these nacken, which is basically a small pea-sized dumpling would be the best way to describe it. And it is sautéed with what seems to be scallions
mm-hmm.
And various types of pork, including this type of pork called speck, which
yeah.
I think is some sort of prosciutto-like cured ham.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Speck is sort of almost a generic term as you go through the whole Tyrolean area and up in, you know, anywhere in the Alps, in the German-speaking Alps.
Okay. And that's basically it. There's usually a fried egg on top.
Right.
So, yeah, I gave you a call because I thought you probably would have my answer.
Now, I have to say, I mean, I've spent precious little time in Austria.
Uh-huh.
The short time I've spent there, I spent about a week and a half in Vienna a long time ago. Mm-hmm. What an evocative city. And,
you
know,
so beautiful.
At this time of year, this is the time of year I went. The coffee was roasting. The leaves were falling. It was like something out of a movie. And so was the food. But I think because I was at a time in my life exposed to some Austrian food, I'm going to make some educated guesses.
Okay.
Are you sure it was a knock?
It was something like that. It started with a K.
Right,
it being German.
Because,
it might have been knocken or noodlin or something
right,
like
noodlin,
that.
Because noodlin or noodle or whatever is usually referring to the dumpling.
Okay.
Now, what I'm thinking is that this is very similar to spätzle.
Okay.
Or spätzle. And usually what this is it is a dough that is done with flour,
okay.
milk,
uh-huh.
egg.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And the idea is that you warm the milk and a little bit of butter.
Mm-hmm.
You warm the milk and the butter and you gradually beat in the flour and then the egg and you just cook it a little bit. All right, until you get a nice dough that mm-hmm. you then knead. And then you're talking about little tiny pieces, right?
Yeah, they're little, almost pea-sized.
Were they grooved in any way?
I didn't examine it that closely, unfortunately. But yeah, they were irregular would be the best way to put it.
All right. Well, because there's a couple ways you can do it. You can literally break off pieces and rub them between your hands to get little pieces. Or you can there's a board that is sometimes used that has grooves in it where you kind of roll the pieces over that.
Huh.
Almost the way you would like a gnocchi if you were making gnocchi in Italy.
Okay, yeah.
Okay. But the idea being that you want to get little pieces of dough that are compact and you let them rest a bit. You boil them, all right, until they're tender. And generally, it's the case you put them in the water, they simmer very gently, mm-hmm. and when they rise to the top and you don't taste any raw flour, they're done. And then they go into the skillet. Now, in the skillet is where you might take something like a really lush ham that is salt cured, not the typical ham we get in the supermarket, those pumped babies. You know what you could use? Mm-hmm. If you don't have a ham, you could use cured pork shoulder, or you could use a combination of really good lean bacon, dry cured bacon, and that's what you melt in the pan, and you sauté lightly, and then you throw this in with the scallions or with a little browned onion.
Okay.
You see, and that will give you, I think, that effect. I think it'll work for you.
Yeah, would something like pancetta work at all?
Yeah, okay. It would, because that's pretty close to that flavoring. Speck can often be smoked, but it's generally, it's the fact that it's not sweet.
Right, exactly.
And it's not packed with water. It's a dry cure.
We have a wonderful food co-op around here that has a lot of different types of ham products and all this amazing stuff.
Well,
so I can probably find something like that there.
And your job will be that maybe every other night you will just have to use yet another ham product and try that recipe again, and you'll just have a delicious time.
That would be wonderful.
But that's pretty close. This idea of the dumpling where you make this dough, and the dough doesn't have to be super firm, but it has to hold together when it hits the water.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, and one of the tricks is after you work it, let it rest.
Okay.
And after you shape the noodle, let it rest. It's kind of like pie crust. So
Let
us know how that works. I think it's going to help you out.
Will do. Thank you so much for your help.
Hey, you take care.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye. Call us 800-537-5252. Let's see, who's up next? We have Jennifer calling from Shaftesbury, Vermont.
Shaftesbury, yep.
Thank you, Jennifer. What do you want to talk about, girl?
I want to talk about goats.
Goats. Nobody ever wants to talk about goats. What's
with
the goats?
I know. I've looked on your website and looked and looked and looked under recipes, and it's like, nobody has anything for goat meat.
I have to tell you something. Goat is a hard sell. It's like trying to sell rabbit at Easter.
Well, around the rest of the world, they eat it, and the ethnic groups in this country eat it.
You got it. You're right. And you know, goats have been a mainstay. A goat or a sheep can live in places that a cow, you know, won't even put a hoof into because they can't survive.
That's right.
Yeah. So wait a minute. Have you got goats?
I've got about 350 of them.
Oh, brother. So you're saying, what can you do with young goat meat?
Right.
Okay. There's an easy answer here.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that you can do with lamb, you can do with young goat.
Okay.
And it may be a little leaner than young lamb.
Mm-hmm.
But trust me, it can be, well, first of all, I think you know, goat, you're right, people are very prejudiced against goat meat.
Right.
It is delicious. You can do the chops, just sautéed or grilled, you know, on a grill outdoors. It's fabulous.
Right.
There are any part of the animal, like the shoulder, parts of the leg, the shank, that kind of thing. They braise beautifully. And there's, you know, you look at Caribbean recipes, goat is used. You look at recipes from India. If you look at Middle Eastern, Moroccan, North African, Mexico, go around essentially the Sun Belt, right?
Right.
And look at all the cultures that come out of that broad band completely around the globe.
Right, Africa.
Africa. And you can find anything that you do with a lamb, you can do with a goat.
Okay.
I remember from southern Italy, small goat chops, essentially, that had been just left with olive oil with a lot of black pepper. And fresh oregano, and they had been left in the refrigerator overnight, and then they were grilled over very moderate fire, but it was wood.
Yeah.
It was fabulous. It was fabulous. Slow cook. As I said, I tend to slow cook these things because they can be a bit on the lean side.
Right.
A leg will be wonderful.
Okay.
Hey, thank you. Take care.
Bye.
Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Have a great week. And until next time, let me leave you with this Chinese saying. It goes this way. He that takes medicine and neglects diet wastes the skills of the physician. The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and supported by Room & Board. Handcrafted furniture for your home at roomandboard.com. Information on nearly everything you heard here today can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. Not only will you find priceless newsletters and podcasts, you'll find information on our must-have new book, How to Eat Supper, Recipes, Stories, and Opinions. I think that title says it all. Anyway, check it all out online at, you know where, splendidtable.org. Our show is supported in part by Palm Wonderful, 100% authentic pomegranate juice backed by $25 million in medical research. You can learn more about the antioxidant superpower at palmwonderful.com. Palm Wonderful, trust in Palm. And by gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about food, menus, and cooking at gather.com. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Andrew Schumacher and Judy Boudreau. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. Have a great week. Please join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.